From the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, this is Politically Georgia. I'm Patricia Murphy. Today, we'll look at some of the women running in Georgia's upcoming elections, along with the issues female voters will consider as they go to the polls. We'll talk with Melita Easters, founder and executive director of the Georgia Win List, about all of that and more.
I'm Greg Bluestein. We'll also be joined by Deputy Secretary of State Jordan Fuchs to discuss changes voters may see at the polls when they're casting ballots this year. And we'll ask, just how funny is Brad Raffensperger? Because the letter that Raffensperger wrote to Larry David after the Hollywood star spoofed a Georgia election law on Curb Your Enthusiasm showed he can give as good as he gets.
You know, 6 to 8 months is a lifetime in politics.
I'm Bill Nigut. That's Marty Kemp saying that unlike her husband, the governor, she's not ready to say she'll cast a ballot for Donald Trump.
We invite you to follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode of Politically Georgia.
In Atlanta, one voice has stood out for over 4 decades. An AJC original, The Monica Pearson Show.
Let's talk about how you got to ESPN.
Revealing interviews.
You are known as America's doctor, but I want to know who you were before that.
When you have a different name, you have different color skin, it can be tough.
With Atlanta's most famous faces as you've never seen them before.
I'm telling my story. This is the American dream.
The Monica Pearson Show, streaming now on AJC.com.
Donald Trump has been indicted in Atlanta.
We have so many court dockets to follow, but we haven't really seen anything yet.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution has covered every moment of this historic case.
I've been writing about this investigation for 2.5 years.
Our team is led by reporters Bill Rankin and Tamar Hallerman. Follow our coverage on AJC.com and listen to new in-depth episodes of the award-winning podcast, Breakdown, The Trump Indictment, only from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Before we bring in our guests, guys, I have to tell you, as a native Atlantan, happy 404 Day, Bill Nigut.
I love 404 Day. Not the least reason is being that Nike puts out a 404 shoe. I'm a sneakerhead,
wow.
And I'm looking to find a pair of the Nike 404s for this year. They're really good looking.
Greg, do you have your 404s yet? I don't even know what we're talking about now.
I just want to take a picture
of Bill 4th.
In Walter in the line outside
Walters.
To buy that shoe.
Okay. Well, now that we've gotten the really important work out of the way, we are going to bring in Melita Easters, the founder of the Georgia Win List, an organization dedicated to changing the face of power in Georgia by electing pro-choice Democratic women to statewide office and in the General Assembly, and I believe a few other offices as well. But Melita, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Nice to see you in your new digs.
Thank you. Tell us a little bit about Georgia Win List in your own words. You certainly were a guest on Political Rewind many times, so that portion of the audience knows exactly who you are. But tell us more about Georgia Win List for our audience who you're new to.
Well, Georgia Win List was started in 1999 after a very wonderful woman candidate at the time for lieutenant governor had lost her race, Mary Margaret Oliver. And we decided that we needed in Georgia something like Emily's List on the national level to help women overcome the good old boy network and get elected to statewide office. Now, at that time, Democrats had a trifecta of state power. And we started just as Republicans took power. So we have fought for years to elect women. And even though Republicans have a trifecta of power, Democratic women in the General Assembly outnumber their Republican women counterparts 3-1. And that's a testament to the efforts we've made to elect women in Georgia who are pro-choice Democrats.
Oh, that's fascinating. So help us set the table. You have done so many cycles over the years. Tell us how 2024 is different from previous cycles and what it means for your group.
The reason it's different primarily is the fact that now that Dobbs has been ruled on to overturn Roe v. Wade and 50 years of precedent for pro-choice policies about abortion in this country, this is the first election cycle where women who qualified for office qualified knowing that their rights were no longer secured, that medical autonomy was no longer granted. And so it has generated more women candidates on our side of the aisle than we've ever seen before.
Yeah. So suddenly abortion is in the conversation. IVF is in the conversation. Have you had candidates either come to you or have you been recruiting candidates who said this is the reason that they're running?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We were interviewing candidates last night who are in primary contests, and one of them said, we need more women in office. We're tired of men making decisions about our health and well-being.
Melita, some cycles it's easier than others to recruit. How would you grade this cycle? Because, you know, we've written in the past about how there's many races that went unopposed, even some winnable races. And this year, there's only a handful of really, truly competitive races.
That is true. But we now see that with the Alabama decision about IVF, with the recent special election in Alabama, races that might not have been thought competitive are suddenly more competitive because women are more empowered to be bold in their message, and women are more empowered to really vote in higher numbers than ever before.
And talk a little bit more about that Alabama House special election, how it translates to Georgia.
The way it translates to Georgia most immediately is that the Huntsville area of Alabama is where this election occurred. And that woman won. Marilyn Lance flipped a GOP-held seat she had lost when she ran 4 years before by a 63-37% majority. That's a big margin of victory for a race she had lost by, I think, 7% before. So that makes people like Deborah Silcox, a Republican legislator, Speaker Pro Tem Jan Jones, Scott Hilton, Matt Reeves, people in the suburbs where there are highly educated middle ground voters who might be more motivated to vote for a pro-choice Democrat than the incumbent Republican who has been opposed to abortion.
You know, we talked about that special election in Alabama on the show the other day and said that really sent shockwaves through the Republican ranks across the country because it was another example, Melita, right, of just how important the issue of choice can be across party lines.
Well, and that election happened before the Florida Supreme Court decision, which allowed a six-week ban to be put in place in 30 days. So in 30 days, you have a solid wall of abortion bans that starts in Texas and goes all the way up to Virginia. So any woman in the South past 6 weeks pregnancy will have to either have a medication abortion by mail, by securing pills in some other fashion, or will have to travel out of state. That is a massive shift, and that was not the case 2 years ago. Because if you remember 2 years ago, Georgia's 6 weeks ban was not yet firmly in place.
Melita, talk about the process. You said you just interviewed some candidates last night. You've already endorsed six women who are running. And, of course, they're all pro-choice. That's really key to the endorsements you make. The women have to be pro-choice. How many women do you interview in a given cycle? How does that work?
Well, so people apply with an application, and that is part of how we determine that they're pro-choice. But we ask them about other things, and then we review the applications and decide who we endorse. Winlist never endorses unless they're currently serving incumbents whom we already know. And there are 25 contested races with currently serving Winlist endorsed incumbents. And then there are 21 Winlist endorsed incumbents who have no opposition this cycle. But there are about 15 other races that are contested primary races. And mm-hmm. some of these contested primary races are major big deals because you have three prominent senators who've served more than two decades each who have all retired. And those are going to be primary only contests for who represents these important districts. And then we have women running, and we'll interview them after the primary, for general election contests in parts of the state, like in Northwest and Northeast Georgia and Extreme South Georgia, where they're running against people who've never had opposition in like a decade. And so that is going to be very interesting. Most of those women, we used to call them kamikaze candidates because they didn't have a snowball's chance. But now we call them champions because they champion democratic values and they champion the pro-choice message and they champion the differences between Republicans and Democrats.
It helps build the party from the ground up,
too. They help, yes. And we have another phrase that we like to say, the rising blue tide lifts all boats. And my favorite example for that is there's this wonderful firecracker of a woman who has served on the Windlass board, but now she's currently running for a House Senate. Her name is June Criss. Patricia's met her.
Yes, I have.
June ran 4 years ago in the second most red Senate district in the state, but she moved the Democratic performance of that Senate district by 1,100 votes. One-tenth of the 11,000 President Biden won Georgia by. So the grassroots support for a woman candidate who knocks doors and gets the message out can make a difference even on the national level.
Let's talk a little bit more about the differences now for female voters going to the polls in 2024 as opposed to 2022, specifically because of Roe. So because of that Florida decision, many women in South Georgia could drive across state lines
Absolutely.
To go have a procedure. They're now, of course, after the IVF decision in the Alabama Supreme Court, most IVF clinics have reopened, but not all. And there was an announcement from the IVF clinic at the center of that controversy that sparked that Alabama Supreme Court decision. They will close permanently at the end of the year and move their IVF operations to another state, but they haven't said where that's going to be.
Well, and when you have state legislatures dabbling in the practice of medicine by passing legislation about how highly trained doctors can practice medicine, then that creates a cloud of confusion for those physicians. I mean, we're going to see doctors making decisions who are coming out of medical school, making decisions about where they choose to practice based on the kinds of laws that are in place in a state and the propensity of a legislative body to practice medicine without a license. And for example, you mentioned the Florida. Before Dobbs, Florida typically had 50,000 abortion procedures a year. In 2023, after the state started banning abortion throughout the South, that number rose to 84,000. So that's a lot of women who are going to be looking for abortion care in other places.
We're here with...
Oh, you go ahead. Go ahead, Greg. Continue.
We're here with Melita Easters, the executive director of Georgia Windlist. And Melita, there's a lot of Republicans who think that Governor Brian Kemp, sort of a blueprint, not just to win in a Donald Trump era when there's a lot of middle-of-the-road voters who don't support the former president, but also in the post-Roe era. And I go back to 2022 midterm where Governor Kemp didn't lead with his support for abortion restrictions. He didn't shy away from it when he was asked, but he didn't focus on it, focused on more middle-of-the-road issues once he got to the general election campaign. And there's a thought from Republicans they're trying to do that again this cycle, talking about teacher pay raises, talking about immigration policy that might have broader support, talking about tax cuts that were enacted. How do your candidates who you've endorsed plan to counter that?
Well, our candidates will make abortion care one of their top priorities because we all know that just because they're not talking about it doesn't mean they wouldn't adopt further bans, a ban on medication abortion or a saying that life begins at conception. You're just a few votes away from those kinds of policies we've seen in Alabama and Florida. Now, Georgia Republicans have been smart about not bringing these issues to the forefront because they know they're losing issues. 72% of Americans support access to prescription medication for abortion. Almost that many support medical autonomy for women to make personal decisions about reproductive health care between themselves and their doctors.
Melita, the election in Alabama, the special election, was a very strong example of how a pro-choice candidate can win over a Republican district. But just expand that to a national frame for just a moment. Republican Donald Trump has said now he will support a 15-week national ban on abortions. Obviously, Joe Biden is pro-choice. But the question that people continually ask is, in a larger scale election like that, does abortion just become one of a smaller set of issues that aren't necessarily going to determine where voters go? Or do you think it's going to be a determining factor?
I think it's a determining factor. First off, I'm not sure right-thinking people who are sane in their thought process believe anything they hear Donald Trump promise, because he's proven to be very liquid in his core values. But women don't want Republican legislators in their medical exam rooms. Women like myself, of a certain age, don't like the idea that our granddaughters grow up into a life where they have fewer options than we did. My daughters are of the age that their families are complete, but I have six granddaughters, and I want them to be able to choose when they have their children and who they have them with. There's one saying that Republicans believe rapists should have the option of choosing the mother of their children, and Democrats believe women should choose the father of theirs.
Let's talk a little bit about some of these races individually. If we go back and look at some of the candidates that you have endorsed before, very familiar names to people to anybody in our audience. Sonia Halperin, Nikki Merritt, Terry Anulowitz, Michelle Au, Stacey Evans, Elena Parent. Now, a number of those women are from the increasingly Democratic suburbs of Atlanta. And some of your targeted races look like they're in those neighborhoods as well. What do you think are your best chances for a pickup out of these? I know you don't like to pick favorites, but what are the most competitive seats, do you think? And where this issue of abortion, IVF, contraception will really make a difference?
Well, three seats that are highly competitive potential flips are Laura Mavrodian, House District 48. It's a Gwinnett Fulton County seat currently represented by Republican Scott Hilton. Deborah Shigley is hoping to flip House District 47. Now, absolutely yes, the Republican in that seat is President Pro Tem of the House, Jan Jones. But Deborah Shigley has raised more money than any candidate who's ever opposed Jan Jones. And Deborah Shigley is a pro-choice, pro-public education, Harvard-educated mother of five whose children go to public schools, and Jan Jones has pushed vouchers. Susie Greenberg is one of my favorite candidates. She is opposing Deborah Silcox. She's raised more than $300,000 in a district that's the number one target for the House caucus. There couldn't be a better candidate. Michelle Kang is running for House District 99 against Republican Matt Reeves. It's a majority-minority Gwinnett County district, and she has a great chance of defeating him. She's been a longtime grassroots advocate. Then down in Macon, you have a newly created majority black district, and Tanji Herring is running for HD 145.
And that's an open district, right?
That's an open district. There are also a number of other open seats where we will be making decisions on Sunday about some promising candidates who have the opportunity to flip seats or win open seats.
And Democrats are expected to have a net gain of a couple seats anyway because of redistricting, but you're looking to make that gain even bigger.
Frosting on the cake.
Felita Easters, you just mentioned vouchers too, because we spend a lot of time talking about abortion rights, but vouchers is going to be a major issue in this campaign. This was a long-sought goal of Republicans to spend more public money in private education. It passed. The governor's going to sign it. I'll be shocked if he doesn't. It was a priority of Republican leaders. They feel like it's going to help ignite the conservative base as well. But sounds like you think there could be a counter response from Democrats.
There will absolutely be a counter response from Democrats on that issue. And there will be a counter response from Democrats on the whole expanding Medicaid issue. And so Democrats have a strong story to tell that will resonate with the grassroots of our own party and those in the middle.
Melita, let me talk about statewide races. Now, that we're not going to have constitutional offices on the ballot in this upcoming election.
Well, we do have one contested Supreme Court seat.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But we don't have any of the lieutenant governor,
right.
The attorney general aren't on the ballot. And we, you know, people talk about Georgia as a purple state because the state elected Joe Biden and John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock, but we still have every Republican office, I mean, every statewide constitutional office is held by a Republican. What do you see as you move forward and look at 2026? Do you believe that you can start early to find candidates for those statewide races? Jen Jordan seem to be the closest to having an opportunity to become attorney general. She raised more money than any other candidate, and yet she still failed. Is Georgia really changing to make those opportunities more realistic?
Yes, and there's a lot of new voters who will have registered between 2022 and 2026. They will be younger, more progressive, more diverse voters who will find the diverse ticket Democrats will put up. I don't know who will be on that ticket, but it will be a big tent diverse ticket against a stale, pale, male Republican slate.
Let's talk about what's not going to be stale, pale, and male. Is the primary field for Senate District 44. That's an Atlanta-based state Senate seat where Elena Parent is the incumbent. She has a Democratic primary challenge coming up here in May from former state Senator Nadine Thomas, who's also a Democrat. So what do you do in a district like that? Because I know that Senator Parent is somebody who y'all have endorsed many times.
True. And we stick with Elena Parent because she is one of our own. That will be a competitive race, but I think Elena has an amazing record. She will raise a lot of money, and it is disingenuous for Ms. Thomas to have on her website re-elect Regina Thomas when she has not served in office for more than a decade.
Melita Easters, when you mentioned the statewide race that is on the ballot, both Patricia and I gave each other a glance, our eyebrows raised. That is the race for Supreme Court Justice between Andrew Pinson, who is a Governor Kemp appointee, and former Congressman John Barrow. It's nonpartisan, but of course, Congressman Barrow was a Democrat, and he's making this race about abortion rights. So do you expect Winlist to play in that race?
Winlist does not play in races with male candidates. But John Barrow has been a friend of Winlist. In fact, his sister, Ruth Barrow Bracewell, was one of the first women we endorsed in 2000 when she ran for a state house seat. Regrettably, she lost. But John Barrow certainly has the kind of record which will make him an attractive candidate to many of those who will be going to the polls to vote for our women candidates.
A couple more questions here. We could talk to you all day long, but we're not allowed to because we have another guest coming in. When you talked about Scott Hilton, he is somebody who took a lead on a Day 40 resolution that was pushed by Speaker John Burns to essentially declare the state house opinion that IVF should remain accessible. There was not an up or down vote because it was a resolution. The state Senate did not take action on it, but it caught our attention for many reasons, but especially because IVF, I think in some of these districts that you're talking about, including Scott Hilton's, who took the Republican lead on that, could really be a factor.
Absolutely. I think we all know, just as we all know, women who have miscarried past the 12 or 16 week state of a pregnancy and needed abortion care as emergency medical care. We all know families who've been able to have children only because of IVF. None of us would take a newborn and put it in the freezer. And yet, to try and call fertilized eggs the essential equivalent of a baby is ludicrous. And so I think Hilton's efforts to put himself on the side the public prefers of that issue are obvious for what they are, pandering.
Bill, any more questions?
No, No, but you're right. We could talk to Melita all day.
That just means you need to have me back.
We 100% will. What are you going to be doing between now and the May primary and, the, of course, the November election? You're still selecting candidates?
We will select our primary endorsed, the remainder of our primary endorsed candidates in a meeting on Sunday afternoon. So we'll promote all of those women. Then after, shortly after that, we will go over the more than 30 candidates who are in general election contest only, who will be vying for an endorsement. We'll be promoting candidates throughout that time on our regular e-blast, on our website, and our social media post at gawinlist.com. And then we have some special events for fundraising, because to elect women in record-setting numbers, you must raise money in record-setting sums. And so there's a lot of that involved in my immediate future. But we're excited about the opportunities this year offers for increasing the number of Democratic pro-choice women in the General Assembly.
All right. Well, Melita Easters, founder and executive director of Georgia Winlist, thank you so much for coming in studio. And you know we will have you back as these races heat up.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
This is Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Hip-hop is a product of Black people. It's a product of Black song. A celebration.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution presents
hip-hop's most pulled elements are pulled from the South.
A Southern hip-hop story.
We always go back to that moment of the Source Awards.
Everybody wants your rhythm, but they don't want your blues.
The biggest names in hip-hop.
Atlanta is still the mecca for hip-hop.
50 years.
No one can deny.
One film.
The power of the South now.
The South got something to say. Streaming now at ajc.com/hip-hop.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Twice daily, delivered straight to your inbox, you can receive the AJC's Politically Georgia newsletter. Stay on top of all the important news, scoops, and exclusives from me and the rest of the AJC politics team. Just go to ajc.com/newsletters and sign up today. That's ajc.com/newsletters. Well, we're going to welcome our next guest, Jordan Fuchs, to the show. Jordan is a Deputy Secretary of State in Brad Raffensperger's office, and we have a lot to cover with Jordan here today. Jordan, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. Always enjoy your show.
Thank you so much. Let's start off talking about changes that voters may see when they go to the polls, either in May or in November. I actually need you to tell us if some of these changes to Georgia election law, if those went into effect immediately or if they will not play a role until the November elections.
A lot of these that they have passed but not yet signed into law really don't affect Georgians whatsoever. I've been kind of reading through some of the materials. A lot of the things that they have been proposing, they being the General Assembly, don't go into effect until 2025, 2026. One of the cool things that they did pass was we are going to pilot some software that independently audits every single race on the ballot, and it reads the human readable text, which in plain English just means what the words on the page will be audited. And I think that's a step in the right direction to kind of shore up some confidence that we saw, that was lost in 2020 through various rhetoric. But I think that's the step in the right direction to kind of shore up confidence. As far as what voters are going to see at the polls, it's going to be the same experience that they had in 2022.
Hopefully not 2020.
And, 2020, I don't want to relive. But 2022 was a really great election. Very smooth. We didn't have a pandemic. Nobody contested the election. It was great. So let's relive that one.
Jordan, it's Greg Bluestein. I'm going to ask you specifically about SB, Senate Bill 189, which, as you mentioned, has not been signed by Governor Kemp yet. We don't know if it will be signed. That's one of the ones that are more up in the air. And it does affect the ability to challenge voters' eligibility. It does have this provision that eventually will eliminate QR ballot codes on ballots. But it also includes a provision that would make it easier for independent candidates for president to get on the Georgia ballot. It says as long as they're on the ballot in 20 other states, at least they can get on the ballot in Georgia. That seemed to be a surprise to a lot of people in the legislature. Where did that come from was the question I got the most. Do you know where that came from? And does the secretary have a stance on this overall bill? Does he hope it gets signed? Does he hope it gets vetoed?
As far as where it came from, I don't think that these individuals sat down with any type of election attorney to review what they were doing and how it would have an impact on elections. I don't think it's going to get signed into law, but I can't predict the future and I don't have any insight. But it was interesting. It definitely came out of the blue. And any election attorney expert would say this probably wasn't the greatest idea.
Well, I just wonder if anybody's looked at the calendar in terms of when various states complete the process of putting a candidate on the ballot and how that runs you up against the deadlines that you need to have in mind for getting your own ballot organized for the fall.
Yeah, like I said earlier, I think if you're going to draft legislation that has an impact on election officials, you should sit down with them, get their input. It's very clear that they didn't look at a calendar. They didn't take into consideration the timelines. And I do wonder if it was targeting one particular independent candidate, but who really knows?
And would that be RFK Jr.? Is that the one particular candidate you're thinking of?
I won't name names, but that's not a part of my job. But it was a big surprise to a lot of folks, and we'll see what happens.
Jordan, there was also an effort in the General Assembly to push the use of hand-marked paper ballots, and there one measure seemed to have a bit of a pilot program happening at the county level in some cases. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and where it ended up?
I think the push coming from various activists, they don't really know what they're asking for. We had hand-marked paper ballots. We went through Bush v. Gore, and the response from Bush v. Gore was, let's go electronic. Our ballots are becoming more complicated. Hand-tallying a ballot is very difficult, and it is you will see more human error in that process and really any other process if you hand count a ballot with multiple contests. I don't think that's the reality of where Georgia is going to be. I don't think that will ever pass. People have surprised me, but I don't think that this is a real thing.
Jordan, in the aftermath of the 2020 election and the former president's efforts to overturn the results here in Georgia and elsewhere, Secretary of State, your boss, Raffensperger, came under fire by Republicans in the legislature. They took actions to remove him from the state election board and other measures suggesting that your office was somehow the enemy. To what extent do you think that has calmed down at all 4 years, 3 years, 2 years later? Or are you still fighting battles based on what happened in the aftermath of the 2020 election? With the legislature, I mean.
I think the relationships have improved. And the folks who want to do real election and administration and really improve the process, those individuals have worked with us. And it has gone smoothly. And then, of course, at the early start of the year, you had a couple of people play politics with this issue, but it ended up failing. And at the end of the day, I think when they originally were calling for all of us to be investigated, it came off hyper-partisan, hyper-political, and people saw through it.
Jordan, let's go to a moment of levity now that we've talked about some of the more serious stuff. In the last season of the series Curb Your Enthusiasm, Larry David gets arrested in Georgia for handing out water to a voter in the searing sun and gets thrown in jail and then ends up taking a Donald Trump-like mugshot in the Fulton County Jail. The secretary, your boss, wrote a, in Larry David's words, a pretty, pretty, pretty biting letter, but it was hilarious, back to Larry David. How does something like that come together? And what do you know of Larry David's reaction to that?
So I don't think anybody anticipated this ever going public, but we are also subject to open records, and Greg is very clever. So
Greg got it through an Open Records Request Act, we have to say.
So this was a mutual friend of ours, and we all thought it was funny, and it was meant to be funny. And at the end of the day, I don't think it was, no one anticipated it going public. And so I think the secretary was true to nature and showed that he can punch back in a funny way and defend Georgia's voting law, SB 202. And Larry's show is funny, and it points out kind of the ridiculous nature that the left has taken this particular issue. Nobody has been arrested for water. That's not real. And if you do want water, and if you want to donate water to a polling location, election officials are willing to hand those out. The other thing that I would point out is that our lines in 2020 were a product of the pandemic, was a product of not being able to recruit poll workers and other things. And so since then, we've taken the lessons learned from 2020, and our wait times have gone down by 2 minutes, 1 minute, that kind of stuff. So I don't think that this is a real issue. I do understand why campaigns pick up on it. It's very entertaining.
Now, Jordan, have you heard back from Larry David is what we really need to know also.
Oh, excuse me. No, we have not heard back. But I've been told through the mutual friend who hand-delivered the letter that it was well-received, and he thought it was very funny.
Jordan, I don't understand why you wanted to keep that private. It's very, very funny. Were you trying to preserve Secretary of State Raffensperger's image as a somber engineer with no sense of humor? I mean, he's obviously a very funny guy. Why didn't you just release that publicly? I'm just curious.
It was an inside joke between two friends, and I respect this particular friend, and she would throw me out a window if I named her. Yeah, so.
Well, Greg's next Open Records Request Act motion, I'm sure, will be looking for the co-friend.
But Jordan, on that point though, you just said it's ridiculous. No one has been arrested for violating the water handout, but it's still a law, right? It's still on the books. And so, how do you navigate that? Because a law is a law. It's been upheld actually in a court challenge. It wasn't struck down, I should say. Technically, law enforcement could sanction someone for doing exactly what Larry David was, maybe not haul him off the jail, but at least give him a ticket for doing what Larry David was in this show charged with.
So I think the intent of the law was to tamp down some of the campaign tactics that we saw, where we were getting multiple complaints from voters that people were campaigning in line under the guise of handing out water. And we all know that that's not allowed. And so this was just an extra measure to tackle that. If someone wants to donate water to a polling place, you're welcome to do so. It's just you cannot use it as a guise to campaign in line.
Jordan, it seemed also to kind of follow along the theme, even though it was presented in a very humorous format in a letter to Larry David, that Republicans have been very sensitive about SB 202, that it was characterized by Democrats and activists as just straight up voter suppression. And we do see Republicans continuing to push against that every time that there is record turnout, every time that we see participation continue to increase in Georgia, push against the Democrats' message that SB 202 was egregious in some ways. The message from Republicans is that's not the case.
Yeah, the reaction to it was pretty ridiculous. And when it was first passed, even the media came up to us and said, this bill really isn't that bad. And I think there was a narrative that was lost because there were a lot of ridiculous bills that had been dropped earlier in that year. and the narrative was already kind of set. So SB 202 has been a very good bill. It's been successful in shoring up voter confidence, and we have seen that in recent polling, that even almost 70% of Republicans and independents who lean right are saying that they trust their vote, they trust the voting system here in Georgia, which a lot of states cannot say, especially after 2020. There is a massive amount of people nationally who have concerns about the election and the process. But SB 202 was unique because it targeted all of the issues that voters were highlighting. They had concerns about absentee ballots. They had concerns about signature match. And that bill shored up those concerns.
Okay, I'm going to one more question to ask you about recent legislation that went in, and I think also addressed something that SB 202 did, were mass voter challenges. These seem to be fueled by suspicions on the far right, many of them, frankly, sort of whipped up and inflamed by President Trump, who continues to say that the last election was stolen, that we have seen these large scale voter challenges to people who ended up being perfectly legal voters. Lawmakers went in and added language to say that there needs to be probable cause for upholding challenges to voter eligibility. But it seems like probable cause may be in the eye of the beholder. Can you tell us sort of what the challenge to voters' eligibility, where that stands right now in terms of what groups can do if they come in to challenge a voter?
Sure. And that law has been on the books or on code for decades now. So this is not new. I think what the bill did was set parameters on how it can be done. And at the end of the day, what the right has been doing is mass voter challenges. And frankly, it's a product of a failure that they themselves could have addressed on the national level. So many of them, like Mark Davis loves to point out, that there are people on the voter files who move away and we can't get them off of the voter rolls because of federal law. And we had the House, the Senate, and the presidency as Republicans, and we had every opportunity to reform NVRA, and they didn't. They did nothing. And so what you're seeing now is kind of them playing catch up, trying to better clean the voter rolls and get folks off the voter rolls who they have identified that have moved away. And there is a set process for that.
Okay. Well, Jordan Fuchs, Deputy Secretary of State for the State of Georgia, thank you so much for joining us. We took you on a journey from the silly to the sublime to the extremely serious. So we really appreciate you joining us and rolling with the punches.
Y'all are awesome. Thank you.
This is Politically Georgia from the AJC.
Our journalists at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution are working around the clock to keep you updated on all the developments surrounding the Trump indictment. Now the AJC is putting all of our coverage in one place with our new Trump 19 newsletter. Every Wednesday, you'll have our latest coverage and analysis on this historic case in your inbox. So sign up for free today at ajc.com/indictment newsletter. That's all one word. ajc.com/indictment newsletter.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I'm Patricia Murphy, along with Bill Nigut and Greg Bluestein. We've got a great offer for Politically Georgia listeners, and listen close because it's the South's best deal. For a limited time, you can subscribe and get digital access to the AJC for $1.99 per week for the rest of your life. Subscribe now by going to ajc.com/start. That's ajc.com/start. It's a great deal for the greater Atlanta, and it's for new subscribers only. Guys, let's get into a couple of headlines. And I mean, these are actually kind of doozy. For a quiet news week, it has not been a very quiet news week. Greg, let's start with you. And we're going to talk about Georgia GOP Chair Josh McCown has joined other Republicans to demand that first vice chair of the state GOP, Brian K. Pritchard, demand that he resign from his position. Tell us why.
Yeah, this is going to be a long-running story, guys, because Brian Pritchard was found to have illegally voted while on probation, serving a felony charge of writing a bad check, essentially. And it was transparent. Look, we reported it when he was running for a state House election district, and it certainly was well known to activists who voted to elect him as first vice chair. But now that a judge has basically ruled that not only did he illegally vote, but also he should pay a $5,000 fine and be sanctioned by the state election board. It has renewed calls for him to step down. Marjorie Taylor Greene kind of led the charge, you know, a very avid Trump loyalist. And now Josh McCoon, the party chair, has joined that call for Brian Pritchard to step aside, to step down. He is not stepping aside. And this is why this is going to be a really long, drawn-out process. He is vowing to fight.
Greg, you've been following this story very, very closely. Are there no rules in the state Republican Party that could force him out? Is there no mechanism that would allow Josh McCoon and others who are leaders of the party to get rid of him?
There is, but it's not very simple. Basically, they give 32 days for a hearing. So there'll be a hearing in about a month. And at that hearing, there'll be a chance for Pritchard and his allies to make their case, and there'll be a chance for people who want him to be ousted to make their case. And then it's up to the state Republican Executive Committee, which is a few dozen members, to vote by a two-thirds majority to remove him from office. And remember, we're not talking about a lot of mainstream Republican activists. We're talking about a party that has moved further to the right, certainly than in the last decade, a party that's moved so far to the right that Governor Brian Kemp and a lot of his allies kind of wiped their hands clean of it.
Yeah,
and it's important to note, I mean, how Brian K. Pritchard got to this position in the first place. There was a vote of the membership of the Georgia GOP, hundreds and hundreds of delegates down in Columbus last summer. There were stump speeches by people who all wanted to be vice chair. The allegations against Pritchard were well known at that point. We had reported on them. So this was known by those activists that he had been accused of this. And not only that, that he had been convicted of felony check fraud in Pennsylvania years and years ago. But he's also a very popular conservative internet radio host, very well known to these activists. So I don't know that it would be completely smooth sailing to get rid of him, especially because he's so pro-Trump.
Yeah, this can be a giant headache within the party. And you're exactly right, Patricia. He was well-known within the party's activist core. He might not be a household name to political watchers or our listeners, but among hardcore Republicans, he is very well-known and has a base of support. And there's a lot of people who, you know, he was transparent with them. And I believe him when he tells me that because, you know, we'd quote him on it, right? So he felt like he was being transparent with people, that they weren't in the dark about his past, and yet now he's getting these calls to resign.
Ironic, of course, that Republicans who have talked about illegal voting, which overturned the election in 2020, are not in a frame of mind to reject someone who actually has done it in their party.
And Democrats will say, hey, look, Republicans finally found someone who voted illegally. It is their own first vice chair.
And that's the problem here, because they don't want to have to explain that. What I'm going to be looking for is, does Donald Trump get involved at this point? Brian K. Pritchard is super pro-Trump, but there are overtures being made to the former president to get involved in this. And I think if he speaks, that'll speak volumes.
Yeah, when one of the loudest people out there calling for Brian Pritchard to step down is Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is probably Trump's top loyalist in Georgia, it speaks volumes.
Okay, well, let's get to our next headline. This might be one of my favorite headlines all week. Georgia's First Lady Marti Kemp was asked this week if she's voting for former President Donald Trump, and she didn't say yes.
We've got a long way going. I would probably write Brian Kemp's name in. He'd make a darn good president, in my opinion.
Okay, there are two things that I think are so interesting. First of all, did not jump on the Trump bandwagon. Second of all, advanced the notion of Brian Kemp for president.
Yeah, Patricia, and Marty said that to Channel 2 Action News' Karen Greer in an exclusive interview yesterday. And it was really interesting. You're right, because A, you know, of course, there's been that speculation that Brian Kemp could run for president, I should say, in 2028. But also, just a few days ago, it was Brian Kemp who said, hey, I'm going to vote for whoever the Republican nominee is in November, but did not say whether he voted for Trump in Georgia's March 12th presidential primary. So, you know, Marty does not mince words. Anyone who knows her as well as we do knows that is a fact. And there's a lot of still bad blood simmering. And I totally understand why, right? Not only because former President Trump tried to oust her husband from office, but also a lot of his supporters fueled these horrible conspiracy theories that went after her family, her daughters in the 2020 election. And that's going to be hard to put aside.
Well, we've always said that since Donald Trump came on the scene, family dinners have never been quite the same as members argue about the kind of candidate he has been. I doubt that the Kemps are having those sorts of arguments, but it is interesting to see that Marty Kemp has not immediately lined up with her husband on this.
Yeah, well, and what's so interesting is I tend to think that Mrs. Kemp and Governor Kemp tend to be on the same page on a lot. Yeah. So if you can have Mrs. Kemp even decide not to speak out on an issue like that, that is very, very relevant. And Greg, I think it's important for the audience to know just how influential Marty Kemp is down at the state capitol. She is at every press conference, every bill signing. She is not a stay at home and kind of tend to the garden kind of first lady, although they do have a beautiful garden over there. She's a very serious, policy minded and extremely politically strategic woman.
Yeah, I'm glad you made that point. And she comes from a political family. Her father was a member of the Georgia House. She
Bob grew Argo.
Up around politics. She is a core member of his inner circle, is involved in every major decision that Governor Brian Kemp makes, and I think probably every minor decision he makes as well. And as, of course, has championed her own package. And that was what this interview was about on WSB, was about human trafficking. And the latest package of that legislation got overwhelming approval in the Georgia General Assembly this year.
And Bill, I think the other thing that I had thought was interesting, there is this kind of constant chatter about Governor Kemp and his political future. And would he run for the U.S. Senate seat against Senator John Ossoff, who is up in 2026, or 2 years later is an open White House race? Because I'm trying to do the math. Even if Donald Trump wins the presidency, he could not succeed himself. There's an open seat in 2028.
Yeah, I've often said that governors don't make good senators because they're used to being the CEOs of a state, and the U.S. Senate puts them in a position of being one of 100. But if Kemp has ambitions to run in 2028 for president, he really can't be out of the elective office limelight for all that time between when his term as governor ends. So it does seem running for the Senate would be the step toward becoming a presidential candidate.
And we should note also that First Lady Marty Kemp has not ruled out a run herself. There's been a lot of speculation under the Gold Dome about whether she should. I don't think she will, but she has not ruled it out. She just gave a speech to the University of Georgia's School of SPIA School, of which I'm a graduate of, about that. And she was asked, and she did not rule it out.
Okay, well, I want to be first in line to cover the Marty Kemp for Senate race. That would be one. That would be a barn burner all over this state. Well, if you've got a question for the show, you can call the Politically Georgia Hotline anytime. Leave a message and we'll play it back and answer it on our Friday listener mailbag segment. That number is 770-810-5297. That's 770-810-5297. Well, that's all the time we have for today's podcast. You can now hear Politically Georgia live weekday mornings at 10 on 90.1 WABE in Atlanta, or follow us on your favorite podcast app and hear new episodes every afternoon. If you like what you hear, leave us a review and share Politically Georgia with a friend. Join us again tomorrow for Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
I'm Ernie Suggs, race and culture reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
And I'm Ned Ravone, lifestyle columnist. Atlanta has been known as the Black Mecca for so many years, but that means something different to everybody.
It means everything to me. I've been living here for 24 years, and I am still amazed at how rich the city's Black culture continues to grow. Every day I wake up, I learn something new.
Well, you all can learn something new by subscribing to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's new newsletter called Unapologetically ATL. It's all about the people, the events, and the entertainment happening in Metro Atlanta that Black people might want to know about.
Like historically Black colleges and universities.
Atlanta's thriving art scene.
And the city's growing neighborhoods.
Wherever you live, we want to hear from you. We want to hear what issues are important to you.
So subscribe today at www.ajc.com/unapologeticallyATL.
Only from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.